Hello, hello, and welcome to Echoes, a studio drone based podcast. Today we're talking about releases, about bookings, and about how to transform your releases into bookings. I'm with Alex and with Budwin from Liquicity, very talented and smart guys. Could you tell us about yourself a little bit before we dive into the subject?
Well, I think both me and Alex have a very similar background. And story in a way, but we ended up in different positions. I am currently Liquicity's label manager, together with a very amazing team, and part-time A&R events manager as well. And at Liquicity, both together with Alex and Mark Maduk, we do most of the curation of all of the lineups. And before I started at Liquicity, I was a promoter for, 14 years or something, doing a night, local night called Spectrum XL, which was like a 1,000 capacity monthly, bi-monthly night in the Netherlands. And that's also basically where I met Alex.
Yeah. Alex, I'm probably mostly known for being half of NCT, not the one with the curls, but the other one. Like Baudouin said, we co-curate the Liquicity lineups and I do all the bookings. So I'm the Liquicity's booking agent, basically. I also promote my own nights, the curated buy nights in Amsterdam, Paradiso and Melkweg. I have my own agency as well, or at least used to have my own agency, Compass Agency, on which we have quite some Liquicity artists as well. We just joined forces with MB, a big British agency, and we'll take it from there.
Nice one. So Alex, for how long have you been working with Liquicity?
As an artist, I work with them since the first event. I played the first event that was before I joined NCT. And I think about 2.5 years I'm doing the booking, 3 years, I think.
Okay, so that's around a year and a half if we don't put COVID and the virus in, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. But I've been promoting events since 2005. So nearly 16 years ago, I promoted my first event. And from there, and it just went on and on and on and on. And I met Baudouin and Boya.
So you both have a super, super solid background in bookings. Alex, you've been actually doing booking since 2005, so internet wasn't really big at the time. Do you think internet and the rise of social media changed something on how you do bookings and how you think about bookings?
Yeah, I think of course it does. When I started promoting events, it was, the popularity was mainly based on the finals you saw, the headliners that played the other shows. And in Holland, we had this thing called the dmbforum.nl, which is, it was a legendary forum. And that was basically where you got all your information from. So the new releases, the artists that everyone was hyping up about. You got to know all the other residents in Holland. But nowadays, there's a lot to choose from and a lot of different statistics to use, different metrics to use.
So you're talking about metrics. What do you actually look for when you're planning a night, when you want to do an event?
Really depends. Obviously, when we do Liquicity lineups, we look at the own Liquicity roster, which are the artists that we want to get out there, that got cool releases coming up that we know are popular. For instance, for the curated buy, we had the first club event in Holland in a year and a half last night. And that was mainly based on, the sound that we want the curated buy to grow to the next couple of years. And we based the bookings on that. And that's also based on what we feel is popular, basically the music that we like. And I think if you take it, for instance, to Spectrum, the events that Baudouin promoted, or the Champion Sound that we did, I'm not really sure anymore what we based it on, but it was...
I think you can break it down into a few categories and they'll work together. And they, no matter what kind of event you do, they should be kind of true, don't you think? Like, first of all, there's promoters always want to push music they like. So it's very simple. They find the promoter has a connection to an artist or the music they put out and they like it and they want to spread that stuff. So they book the artist. I think that's one of them. One reason somebody based on which you create your lineups. Then there's a more commercial aspect, which you see more in mainstream festivals or bigger festivals, where a promoter is just looking at metrics and knows like, hey, this is a popular artist and they're going to sell tickets because they have a certain fan base. And that still fits within the music I love, obviously. So, but they're going to sell tickets. And then the third one, or maybe there's a few others, but I think you can also say like, there's also the relationship of the artist with the promoter, especially for smaller names, which is very important. So a promoter is like, he knows the artist or somebody, they have a mutual friend or a mutual connection or an agent, whatever. And they book him because they also obviously like their music, but in some way they're inclined to book him because they know them and they also know easily how it fits into their night. So it's always a combination of those three, don't you think?
Yeah, I think so too.
Alex?
Well, yeah, I completely agree with Boudewijn on this. It completely depends on the night. If you throw a big festival, you know you need the headliners. And for those, you look into the metrics, you look into the Spotify popularity. I don't think so much Facebook likes anymore because Facebook, the whole with the parameters and the reach you get there is just goes down and down. But I think Spotify tells a lot, you know, the place that people get, the playlist they're in. But you also look at other big festivals and other events, and you know, what are the headliners that are coming there? What are the reactions on those headliners when they get booked? And from there on, yeah, you take it down to either people you know, the music that you want to push, the talents that you want to push.
So if I understand correctly, it's a combination between stats, metric, socials, but also passion, what you want to hear and what you want to push forward. And taking this into account, do you think these last years, you have more space for these passion bookings, so what you want to push, or do you have less space in regards to artists you have to book to fill your festival like Liquicity?
I think it depends on your brand. Liquicity, we always try to have people come for Liquicity and not for the lineup, even though the lineup in of itself is pretty impressive, but the main, like, we try to focus on the brand or the thing that's Liquicity, so that allows for a lot of passion bookings. However, if you're a smaller night in a city where you need to attract people from the region, especially in countries where there is not so much going on, yeah, you want at least, yeah, I think you're going to be probably gearing up a little bit more towards like data-driven bookings. But there's always room for both, I think. And people have there's a lot of respect for people who obviously only do the passion bookings and can make it work. I guess that's a very impressive one.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest bit to do as a promoter, if you can just, you know, make it work with passion bookings.
Yeah, so having the right balance, and the more passion booking you can get, the more your brand actually is powerful, I guess. You know, I think Liquicity is very good at this. When you look at a Liquicity festival, all the bookings are pretty coherent with the global brand. So big up on this. You were talking about metrics. What do you look for the most? Is it, let's say, Spotify play on a monthly basis? Is it like on a recent release? On the overall discography, do you have a process when you look at metrics, or is it just like a feeling?
I think it's usually a bit of more, if you would go like, if you were a booker who really wants to know if an artist is popular or not, the best thing to do is look at interaction, not so much at clean play. There's artists who can have 5 million monthly listeners on Spotify, but if you put them on the show, nobody would come to see them. In that case, like, social media can be very interesting, obviously. For example, if you take Coven, who does it amazingly. She has they have their own fan base. And you can really see it by the interaction, not so much only the statistics of their plays or likes or whatever.
No, exactly. You don't go for the likes, but if you see a lot of movement around an artist, which usually comes because of interaction, but also, you know, if there's a new tune released and you see loads of people commenting on it, okay, this is sick, you keep an extra eye on it for the artist, you know. If you haven't heard of the artist before, you look into the discography, you look into the Spotify stats, but you mainly go, obviously, also a gut feeling, because, yeah, obviously, we've been around for quite some time, so we know, we kind of have the feeling that we know that what works and what won't work. But if a new guy comes around or a new girl comes around and, you know, a new artist comes around, which I never heard of, the first thing I'll probably do is head over to Spotify and see what else is up and see if it's not just, you know, a hype that just randomly comes to your newsfeed specifically, but really is really built on something.
Yeah, and we obviously, the first thing we do is listen to the music and see if the quality matches the hype around it, I guess, in a way. Or more than the music. I mean, if somebody is an extremely good, talented DJ, you check out what's that all about.
Yeah, and I think with Liquicity, I mean, we do, yeah, next to COVID. We do quite some events a year, so we've got plenty of space to, you know, get new artists on board and see how the crowd could respond to them, both in the announcement as on the party itself. And we base future bookings on that as well.
So speaking about interaction, I think this makes the perfect segue into what I wanted to talk next, which is Patreon. The pandemic, one good thing that the pandemic has created is the rise of patrons. More and more artists have created patrons, and this means creating a really closer relationship with your audience. But as patrons are working in a subscription model, bookers may not have access to the content on Patreon, may not be able to see how close and how big ties are being made inside those Patreon platforms. So as a booker, and when thinking about your event, do you take into account this patron? Oh, look, he has a lot of Patreon subscribers, or look how close his community is to this artist. Is this something you're taking into account when making bookings?
I think if you look at Patreon specifically as a platform and drum and bass, I mean, I think the scale is not big enough yet. I mean, I'm pretty sure who has the biggest Patreon, Noisia or something. I'm not sure. I think they have one of the most followers, but I mean, there's probably, how much would they have? Thousands. That doesn't compare to the amount of audience they reach normally with their music.
Exactly.
So I think it's very cool. If an artist has a very dedicated community behind it, it doesn't really matter on what platform it is. It always speaks to the advantage of the artist. As an artist myself, if I would look at Patreon as a means of getting more bookings, I would never just focus on that. Just that. You should always use all utensils to get to reach an audience. And Patreon is obviously very closed off. So if you think about it, Patreon as a tool of attracting new followers, it's maybe not so smart of a choice, but for as a showcase of how well you connect with people, it's obviously a nice thing.
Yeah, but yeah, in your artist marketing mix, to give it a name, it should just be one of the platforms, and I don't think your main focus as well. I'm happy it's there. It helped quite some artists during the COVID time that we're in.
Yeah, it's amazing.
We obviously have to see how big it will remain or become or whatsoever when we just, you know, go back to the usual day business of clubbing and getting music out there.
All right. And do you feel like since, you know, before digital and internet, mostly the income from artists were made by selling CDs, vinyls, etc. And then there was like Spotify and illegal downloading. And so bookings became the main source of income for artists. And so with the rise of Patreons and a consequent side revenue or even the main revenue, do you think this will rebalance or change how people negotiate their booking fees? For instance, one artist might reject some booking fees saying, okay, I don't have to tour every single week. I don't have to accept this booking fee. I can just stay home and enjoy and do some content for my Patreon.
Well, I don't really think it affects booking fees to make them lower, because obviously what you say, I think that probably hits the spot. If you don't need all the income and you got other sources of income, you don't need to take every booking that you can get. So you can, you know, be more selective on it and perhaps increase your fee a bit, or just, you know, leave your fee as is, but just be more selective on the bookings you take. So you create some kind of new exclusivity for yourself, which in the end can affect your booking fee again.
By the way, circling back on having a Patreon as a tool to showcase yourself towards bookers, what's pretty interesting is that labels these days, Liquidsity does, Monster Cat does, have their own way of patrons. Liquidsity has Liquidsity Astronauts, which is a platform. It's basically Patreon, but part of it is that you get to download for, obviously you pay for it, a certain amount of tracks each month from the back catalog. And what that does is we can see which artists or which releases are popular among our most valuable fans or people who are in the community. Obviously, if you're already a Patreon, you care much about the brand compared to a regular person who listens on Spotify. So in that way, you can really see who your fan base is really interested in. And you can use that tool as, if you have both that as a label and you have your own events, to curate your lineup based on some of that.
That's actually a very good comment. I think also Hospital Record is starting this. They have like a subscription model where you could get some stuff by paying each month. So actually what we can observe is there's a global tendency to create subscription models to reward very loyal fans. But as you're saying, this doesn't directly for now impact bookings.
Yeah, I think with Liquidity, we always even did, we did within our closed Facebook groups, we did even from the start, we've always done like polls, like who do you like? Who haven't we had over at Liquidity who should be there sound-wise, who is talented, who is amazing, but somehow we might have missed. We like interaction with your fan base also as a promoter can be an extremely cool tool to curate lineup.
Yeah, absolutely. And to, I think to be successful as either an artist or a promoter or a label, you need to have a dedicated community.
So maybe a promoter, do you have, I haven't seen many like non-labels, but like club nights or who have their own Patreon accounts as well. Like for example, you're a promoter who has a monthly night, but you can get like, you have Patreons, and if you're a Patreon, you always get in for free or something. That's amazing. Might have some issues to it, but maybe Studio Drum and Bass should think about it.
Yeah, that's actually a very good remark. Studio Drum and Bass are created by or offering more than just a ticket to enter the night, but a whole experience through subscription and rewarding special fans. That's a very good idea to explore.
Subscription models are the models now and for the future for basically everything in life these days, and somehow you don't see a lot of them for events, obviously due to COVID, but hey, maybe somebody starts this shit soon.
I'm writing this down as we speak. So, yeah.
So you're both artists as well? Do you have like a booking agent?
Alex is my agent. He actually is.
Yeah, I actually am.
Yeah, and NCT is on MB artists as well, but that's Mark. He handles the NCT booking, so my partner on there.
Are you happy of Alex's work?
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of Alex.
Yeah, he has another show for a year and a half.
Hey, yeah, no, I did. But to be honest, I don't think Alex has earned any money of me, so I'm not the one to be very critical here. No, Alex is an amazing booker, and I think the way he's looking after artists is impeccable.
So, To speak more about the subject of getting an agent, being part of a roster, do you think right now in 2021, let's say COVID and the virus didn't exist, do you think it's actually possible to make a sustainable income without having an agent? Or is it too much work? Or maybe it's missing the small nudge to make it through? What's your view on this?
I think it is possible to make it without an agent. Obviously being an agent, I shouldn't say it, but yeah, I think it is. But the thing is, it's always a hassle. The whole acquisition bit, you know, the whole contracting, the paperwork, getting your travel sorted, all that stuff, that's basically what an agent's for. And obviously the agent usually has a lot bigger network. He knows how to negotiate. He knows how to get you multiple bookings in one weekend, where as an artist, you probably just focus on, you know, finishing your music, and then you got some emails and you forget to reply to them. So your booking won't come through. And especially for the bigger festivals, they have their preferred agencies. So if you're an artist and you're on one of those rosters, you know that you can play those festivals. You know, you can go to the big club nights because your agent has a certain leverage, which as an artist yourself, you probably won't have until for some reason, I mean, you get like a top 40 hit song and everyone wants to book you. But up until you're on that point, an agent is really, adds the value.
I think you really have to have the character as well. Like you have to be a very proactive, kind of almost business-minded artist, which is a rare combination in these days. So I think you really have to. In drum and bass, there's enough guys who like do that really well, but it really takes a specific type of person to make all that work happen besides being doing the whole music side of it as well.
Yeah, and that's the whole reason that we started with the agency with Compass years ago. We noticed that there were loads of friends of us and loads of you know, good drum-based dubstep artists in Holland. But they just, I mean, the bookings that they had were just, you know, yeah, short money bookings. And usually the gear wasn't fine. And the whole lineup and the billing wasn't fine. And they all, I mean, we had the chats about it. And most of them were like, yeah, how do you guys do this? And I mean, I don't want to be in all this hassle. And that's when we figured, okay, you know, we got the experience being both an artist, promoter. Let's start this and let's give them a helping hand so they can focus on what they're really good in. Yeah, good at making music.
Yeah, I was going to say, being an agent is not like being a producer where you're like, okay, fuck, how do I make a kick? Open YouTube and just, okay, there's like 1,000 tutorials telling you how to make a kick. Like, how do you learn? Where do you learn being a good agent? And like, you know, there's a school of life that teaches you how to be a good agent.
I think the school of life mainly, because I've been a promoter, so I know the promoter side. I mean, they obviously want to have the best artists, not pay too much and don't have too much hassle with the billing and stuff. But I'm an artist as well, so I know that when I'm going to a show, I want to make sure that the show is good, that the gear is good, that the writer is settled, that if there's flights and hotels, then I want those covered as well. And that's what I learned the hard way quite sometimes, that it's not, you know, you can't take it for granted. And the end is just, you know, building experience, just doing it and doing it and doing it and making mistakes and learning from them and onward to the next mistake.
All right, I see. And would you recommend, I know that, you know, that when you grow bigger and bigger, you're going to start separating all the different function or people helping you along the way. So you're going to have a manager, you're going to have a booking agency. Do you think you should separate them early on? Let's say having one manager, or is it best to have the same manager if he can deal with the bookings, having him deal with the bookings?
I think if you think about all those tasks, I would rather get an agent first than a manager. Obviously, if you have a confidant with you or a very good friend you trust, that's nice. But I think I see a lot of artists who are actually pretty proactive and pretty business minded themselves, but they have managers for some reason and they don't really add that much value. But an agent is something that can really straight up get you shows. And it's more like he's less in control. An agent is less in control of what your output as a brand, I think. So I think it's a safer bet to like have an agent. And it's like a manager takes a slice of your total revenue, and an agent actually only takes a slice of what he actually delivers you, which is shows. You know, if you're an artist and you earn, let's say, 2,000 euros a month in royalties, and your manager gets a slice of that, but maybe he doesn't really do that much in reality to get those. To create that revenue for you, or take away effort that create from your daily life, compared to an agent who actually gives you shows. And if an agent doesn't deliver on your shows or doesn't deliver, it's very easy to no harm done if you change agents or start doing it yourself again, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the main thing, if you get an agent or a manager optioned as an artist, the main thing is to be really sure about the stuff that you want to, keep control of and the stuff that you want to give away, because it's easy to say, yeah, okay, now you manage it, you take care of everything, but everything is just always way too much. So you always have to make sure, okay, this is the stuff I want to have, this is stuff that you can do, this is stuff you can do, and don't just step into it.
So being more in control.
Yeah, just to make sure that you're in control of the stuff that you want to be in control of as an artist.
All right, I see. And if you don't have a manager, or you have a booking agent, and for the booking agent that are listening to this, now you have, let's say you're running a night, so you're both running either a festival or you're created by, etc. For you, what's the best way to contact a promoter? To let's say you want to promote your artist, or you're just an artist and you got a release. It can be released, or it can still be in the pipeline to get released. How should you push your work? What's the best way to do it?
I think in a way, if like it comes down to those three points of why somebody would book you. Either they already love your music, or you have a very interesting fan base, or you have a relationship with them. If you already have a relationship with them, it's obviously very easy, and you can have a pretty casual suggestion and conversation with somebody about what you're doing, and you can very casually suggest like, hey, I would love to play. There's no harm there. I think the thing that's most annoying for promoters and least effective is cold calling, as in just emailing promoters like, hey, can you book me? Here's my music. I can guarantee you that's not going to work unless the promoter already knows you and you send him something like unreleased music. I think like boasting your, like saying, hey, I have a massive fan base and I'm going to sell so many tickets, also doesn't really work. But the most important part in drum and bass, I think you should realize, is that promoters love the music and they know who's releasing new music and they know who are the hot new names. And if you're an artist who's up and coming, promoters will definitely know who you are. Usually, obviously there's boundaries there, but I think I would rather focus on getting your name out there and in general, rather than really specifically start targeting promoters. There's a balance, but I think that's the better thing to do. For example, I get a lot of emails of people going like, hey, can you book me? Here's my new single. And at the same time, me and Alex already know, or sometimes we're already massive fans of those artists. We're like, of course we know the new single, dude. Love it. But it's a very useless thing. It's not going to get you anywhere because we already, I think it's better to get like a big overall reach that rather than really specifically targeting promoters yourself, or you really have to build on a personal relationship. And I think how to do that, Alex knows more about.
Well, I think the relationship is, the relationship is usually built at events. I mean, you meet people at events, or for instance, at an Amsterdam Dance event, but mainly just at events. So just, yeah, if you're an artist and you want to get booked, just to make sure you're out there as well, just to make sure that you get to know people, that you get to know other promoters, other artists, and, you know, grow your network. And then
it's actually great.
Yeah, start from there.
So you would say either do your own thing, do your music, and your music would speak for itself and the promoters will get you. Or either build a strong relationship with a non-est relationship with promoters that will, in your love for that night and for that type of event, will get you booked there.
Yeah, I think that's the honest part is a very good addition from you. You see a lot of artists these days, or especially managers, who try to push singles to, for example, they want to get their artist on a certain festival or label night. And they like trying to sell their music for gigs. I don't think that's a very healthy approach for the long term. So they're trying like, hey, if I send you this track for a compilation, can I play at your show? That's something you see a lot actually across different labels, different subgenres of drum and bass. It is not really the right approach, I think. I think if you get to know somebody, you don't already have to exchange a song for a booking. I think if your song is great enough, the promoter will love it and will book you anyways. But there's guys who are kind of in drum and bass kind of like reaching out to promoters they don't even know, but they're doing it such an amazing warm way, and they are already pretty established names that they can be pretty successful. There's a few Australian guys who tour Europe once every year, 2 years, and they basically reach out to all the promoters like very kind, like, hey, maybe I've played before with you, or I played for another promoter you know, and it would be amazing to tour. If you do it in an honest way, it can work.
Any funny maybe artists or booking agents that have contacted you in the past and you're like, what the hell is he doing?
I get annoying emails every week. That's for sure.
Yeah, loads. Yeah, it happens all the time. And also from an agency point of view, that you know, people just randomly search for agencies on Google and just get all the email addresses and just send out the stuff. I mean, I've had emails from guys that make just house music and yeah we saw your agency and you're doing great work and we really love your roster and we think we'll be a good addition to it, listen to our music here. And then it's just, you know, yeah, mainstream house that we don't do anything with.
Yeah, that happened. This is both, you know, all labels obviously get, like, drum and bass labels always get EDM demos. It's the same with like promoting. Like, we get so many emails from random hip-hop artists who want to perform at our festival. Like, why?
But that's obviously, I mean, it's the cold calling and emailing. They just search for a festival or for an agency and a label and just send out massive emails.
Yeah, I think if like mutual stuff helps a lot, though. I think promoters really talk to each other, at least in the Netherlands especially, but worldwide as well. I think if you've played one show, if taken for example in the Netherlands, if you would have played a blackout night, if you got the honor of playing there, then pretty sure like other nights who also feature that kind of music will pay attention to that lineup, and they will go like, hey, who is this guy? And then you can be if you're an honest guy, you can reach out to like another promoter like, hey, I played Blackout and I loved it, maybe I can play at your show too.
What you're saying is also like, okay, we don't want to be contacted by email like if we don't know the person, or do it in an honest way. But what happens, for instance, if you really don't know, like you don't have any relationship, but you want to make an offer or you want to showcase your music, is there a way to reach the promoter even outside the normal channels of communications? Maybe unexpected ways you saw in the past?
I think if someone sends me an envelope with a USB with their music on it, then I want to be signed to the agency. Here you go. And I mean, that works because it's a special way. It takes effort to do something like that.
Yeah. Actually, in my hand right now, wait, I got this today. This is an SD drive full of music, unreleased music from an artist he sent. I mean, I'm going to listen to this. That's for sure. So I think there's like creative ways to get yourself out there. I think for what's also, except for just going the regular way, I think there is this guy now doing the drum and bass on the bike. What's his name? Dom Withing?
Yeah.
Withing? Hardings or Withings, yeah.
Yeah. fucking cool. But I mean, he doesn't, I'm not sure if he produces music, but like, that's such a creative way to not only get your name out there, but I'm 100% sure like he's going to have a lot of bookings in the next few months. Like, don't you agree? Like, I'll bet my ass on it. Like, there, he's going to DJ in a few clubs rather than on a bike.
He doesn't need booking. He creates them. He creates the...
Yeah, that's... Yeah. I think that's also a very important thing you're touching on, is that if you think about all people who DJ a lot right now in drum and bass, right? Think about all headliners. What do they do besides releasing music? They all do something different. Either they have a radio show, a podcast, a label owner. I don't know. Some have...
Events.
Events.
Most of them have events.
Yeah, and then put themselves as headliners. that happens a lot. I think that's also a great tactic. And it's a way to get in contact with promoters as well, besides releasing music. If you're a promoter of your own night, you're definitely going to be in contact with other promoters. And at some point, they're going to invite you. And from experience, like when I used to run the Spectrum XL nights back in the days, the Dutch scene was pretty close. I was just a DJ, didn't release any music, and I've played at every major drum and bass party in the Netherlands because they invited me over, because I was at their party, they were at my parties, and if there's like a warm-up slot or a closing or a graveyard shift, people invite each other. And if they think, and then obviously you have to put your money where your mouth is and be a good DJ.
And that hits the networking thing again, you know, you're growing your own networking. You can do it by either on a label or an event or whatsoever. Just get out there and make sure that you have a chat with the right people, and that just starts with just going somewhere.
Yeah, definitely. What you said about doing something else than just DJing or producing made me think about a tweet from Thijs from Nozia, who said maybe a month ago, he said in 2021, if you're an artist, you're not selling music, you're selling an experience, because selling music is not possible. So you have to sell something more than just the music you're producing. And I think that is very true in a way. You have to either digitally, like you said, maybe Coven, who's creating this connection with her singing, with her performance, or maybe other artists doing artistic work, or the Patreon, who are creating again this sort of community. So
I don't want to have to say like you have to do it. I mean, it's funny that Thijs from Noisia said that, because back in the days they had so many bookings just of their music, obviously. And I to be honest, I still think that's possible these days. Like, you can just like do very well booking wise, getting a lot of shows if that's your goal, obviously, just of your music. But it is a massive advantage if you do more, and that's obviously where it's going to go even.
Final question about bookings directly. Is there a way you do bookings for night, for instance? Is it top down, you start with the bigger artist, or is it a bottom up, or is it okay, I want this artist first, even if he's not the biggest of the lineup? And if so, if you have a strategy, how can an artist use this product by knowing that you work like this to maybe try to get more bookings? No, oh, okay, I'm the outsider of this night, or I'm the biggest artist, so I'm gonna try to negotiate my bookings like this, etc.
That's smart. It's an interesting question, to be honest. Very interesting. Yeah, I think, to be honest, if you think about top down in drum and bass, the pick for headliners, the pool is not, there's not so many. If you think about, if you want to have a big festival, you think about the amount of headliners, come on, that's like 20-ish. Yeah,
and that's for a big festival, that's the obvious place to start booking, because you need to get those, you need to get those logs before you can go ahead.
Even for smaller parties, you know, maybe you're going to have a 400 or 500 people party, you know, maybe there's going to be a bigger artist and a smaller artist. Would you start in terms of popularity, would you start by the bigger, would you start by the smaller? You don't, or maybe you don't think about it. And how can an artist use this to maybe negotiate better?
I think most parties do top down in that sense. I'm thinking back to Alex's Champion Sound days, where they only had one headliner who played for as long as they liked, which is an amazing concept still to this day, by the way. And then they just booked a program around it of either what's left of their budget or what, and then what they're really feeling. I don't think as a smaller name, there's a way to get ahead of that curve, to be honest. I think it's like everything we've discussed so far, as in how you get yourself known, like how you get in the scope of a promoter, like I don't think timing is that crucial when you think about it. As an artist, you don't know what their timing of when an event is booking their lineups anyways, unless you're very deep connected in the scene, but then you don't really need all of these things we talked about to get there.
Though, yeah, I mean, in general, for festivals, you kind of know that for the summer festivals, it's you know, October, November, December, that people start booking. But that changes as well. I mean, it can happen a year in advance if it's about the main headliners. But I think as an artist, if you get an inquiry in, and it doesn't really matter what stage it's in, which stage of the booking process it's in, but it's always worth to make sure that you know what other guys are on the lineup, you know, what the proposed timetable is in advance. So not just say, yeah, I want to play at your party. Yeah, this fee is good. Cool, let's go. But always make sure that you get the other info as well, because that's the point where you know where you're standing. Where you know if you know that, okay, they want to book me as a headliner, then of course you can ask for a bit more money, perhaps, because you know it's a 500 capacity party, they want you as the headliner, and roughly what kind of ticket amount they'll sell. So yeah, that's the only point that you can really influence it.
Well, I think like knowing which promoters which book what kind of lineups is very important. Yeah. Actually, like going back to the cold calling thing again, we receive a lot of emails from guys who play very heavy neurofunk, and they think it's an amazing idea that they play 11 till 12 at just before Hybrid Minds. I think, and obviously then the first thing we do is like, we don't really take you seriously because you don't really show that you're involved in what we do. Like, why would we even, like, then I'm not going to spend too much time going through your mixtape or your music, you know? So I think it's very smart to, and I think the same goes for label, like getting your music signed. Just know if you're trying to proactively get a show somewhere, or if a promoter reaches out to you to get you there, what kind of show it is. It is not only to manage their expectations, but also to manage your own.
Yeah, so simple stuff, knowing who you're talking to, knowing what type of party
it's simple, but it's simple, but no, trust me, 80% of the people do not do this. It's crazy, but yeah. And that's at the end of the day, yeah, that's kind of a tone of voice thing. If you have passion for something and you're involved with it, then you're going to do this automatically. And if you don't, you probably won't.
All right. So last subject, I think it's a tricky one, but since you both have multiple roles in the drum and bass industry, it's about innovation. You're both artists. You both have produced in the past, maybe produce still now. How do you think being innovative and having a innovative release is going to impact your chance of getting more shows? What I mean is, for instance, if you're pushing a sound that is super, super new and that is artistically pushing the boundaries of the genres, there's a quite a good chance that it's going to be rejected by the mass audience. Yet as a promoter, you're trying to also survive economically and to make ends meet with your event. So how do you find the right balance between those two?
Well, that's the whole booking from the heart versus booking from the stats thing, isn't it? Like, from the promoter point of view, well, first of all, from an artist point of view, I would never advise anybody to make music that you think promoters like so you get bookings. So you're like, ooh, Liquid is doing really well right now. I want to make sound like, Hybrid Minds because they sell out Brixton Academy in an hour. That's never good. Like, always make music from what you're feeling and from your heart. And from the promoter point of view, I think if you really love something and you have the space in your evening to push it, then you believe in it, then that's like a no-brainer as well. Even if it's super innovative, if you think back on like the most legendary nights, like there was some kind of innovation there, don't you think? Like, if you would ask any promoter in the world or any DJ, like what have been the greatest club nights in drum and bass of all time, usually the ones they list is nights where something happened that was kind of new for the time in some sort of way, whether it was through sound or through production, I guess.
Yeah, but balancing it out is the key. Obviously, like you said, you need to make ends meet. You need to make sure that tickets are sold. So if you spend quite some money on a headliner, you know that tickets are being sold. So you know you got a bit more budget as well to go into the experimental route and to give it a name. You know, what we're trying to do, for instance, with Curated By, is just give a bit of education as well. You know, it's not just about hard-hitting stuff, but yeah, last night we had Jungle to warm up as well. And, you know, it just went back. I think actually some tunes for Logical Progression got played. I'm obviously happy when that happens. But, but yeah, but I mean, and then that's, yeah, that, it's not played by the names that you know that will sell at the night, but it still makes the night a whole. And
I think the most legendary nights are nights where the promoter, to be honest, doesn't give a fuck, and somehow still enough people show up. That's, if you think about it, those, if I think about the best parties I've been to, the music was for the time totally obscure.
Yeah, do you have memories? Could you recall a good night? Like, you were like, oh fuck, this is like, I'm experiencing new stuff right now.
It's not drum and bass, but the first time I went to a Digital Mystics night, I didn't know what the fuck it was, and it was an amazing, and it was packed. I think it was Melkweg, early days Digital Mystic. They didn't have any lights, only the light on the turntable. It was the only light in the whole room. You couldn't even see who was standing next to you. And the lineup was like stacked for that time. Like James Blake was playing, obviously the whole Digital Mystics roster, and they didn't post a timetable. And it was like pitch black, so you had, judging by the music, you had to realize who was playing. And I remember James Blake was, obviously people knew he was on the lineup, and he just had, I think, Limit to Your Love just came out, and like he played 11 till 12, and people came in like at 1, like, hey, where's James Blake? Yeah, he was warming up at 11, and they were like, fuck. But at the same time, like, the whole energy of something that was totally new would definitely not sell if you think about it, but it attracted enough people that creates magic. Fine.
I think the first event that I did nearly 16 years ago, we just had a lineup of residents, and we had no idea what to expect, and it sold out. And obviously we did everything ourselves, so the whole wardrobe was just one complete mess. We blew up quite some speakers that night, and we got into trouble with the venue owner. But still, it was an epic night from a promoter point of view, but also from you know, the visitor point of view. Finally something was happening, finally drum and bass came on. And I think, yeah, like you said, making ends meet, if you always just, you know, choose for the safe choices, so, you know, just follow the middle road, just go ahead, we book what everyone else is booking and stuff. In the end, you probably won't make ends meet. There has to be some kind of diversification.
Yeah, you have to have some sort of identity as a promoter that gives reason for you to people go to your event. Like, obviously, in early days drum and bass, there were like 4 nights or 10 nights a year. Then you could obviously get away with a little bit more. But these days, obviously, like, if you just book like a Beatport top 3 and that's it, like, in the long run, you probably won't have a party anymore.
All right, cool. Thank you. So thank you very much. I think this was a really, really good chat, really interesting. And we talked about a lot of different subjects. Do you have anything to plug? Let's say an upcoming event, coming show, coming anything. I mean,
well, I think we shouldn't we approach it the other way? Like, if you're an amazing up and coming DJ or producer, you should like put our demo box link or promoter box link in the description of the podcast, so we can maybe give you a platform to perform.
All right, we'll do that.
And yeah, we're just really happy that Waves are back on the menu, at least in most parts of Europe. And yeah, let's just hope we'll catch up on one of those soon.
Yeah, and it's going to be super interesting seeing, you can already see it, but how like new artists who came up basically in the last 2 years who haven't been playing shows a lot and now suddenly are going to explode. That's just amazing to see.
Well, thank you very much, guys. That was really, really cool. This was Echoes, episode 5. See you next time. Bye.